And this is We Ourselves, top of the morning, top of the week. Let's, let's start with how we ought to be dealing with very serious problems this morning. I have two very special guests today, and we're going to talk about the World Trade Center and how those buildings so mysteriously collapsed. And my special guest in studio is Dr. Judy Wood, and I've interviewed her twice before. You can hear it, those interviews on weourselves.org. And none other than John Bloomer. And what we're going to try to determine, since Dr. Wood has determined and documented on her website that the World Trade Center towers were not brought down by arson, by the official theory of airplane impact, fires, and weakened steel collapsing, by conventional demolition with explosives such as RDX, dynamite, etc., nor by demolition via thermite or its variants, and finally, not by fission or fusion nukes. So today, with the help of John Bloomer, who is on the line, an alternative energy scientist will try to narrow down what actually did bring the World Trade Center towers down. And then we're going to take your calls at 588-0893. Dr. Wood, welcome to We Ourselves.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And John Bloomer.
Yeah, hi.
Welcome. Now, Dr. Wood, I'm going to let you start off.
Okay. When looking at this problem and trying to solve this crime, I believe it's very important to start out with what happened. First, establish what happened before you speculate on how it happened, why it happened, who done it, etc. If you start out with how it happened, how it could have happened, you end up going down the wrong path. For instance, you may only know of a slingshot and a BB gun and a firecracker. Well, let's see, of those things, which one might you pick? No, let's not limit ourselves to how it could have been done, but start out with what happened, and which is what I've done on my webpage. That's Jane Doe, no W's in front of it, janedoe0911.tripod.com. And on there I have an article I'm still working on posting called The Star Wars Beam Weapon. If you go to page 4, you will see pictures from above with big holes in adjacent buildings after the towers were destroyed. Now, I don't say they collapsed. They were destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
They're not there. And as you'll see, there's not much material left. For two buildings over a quarter mile high to be gone and to have less rubble than an eight-story building sitting next to it. And that eight-story building, Building 6, has these 24-foot diameter holes, so cylindrical cuts with nothing left in them, just cylindrical cutouts. And what else do we have? Toasted cars about a mile away, where you have this brand-new wax job in one part of the car, another part of the car just totally melted metal, and a nanometer over pristine material. So it wasn't just heat gradually heating up the car. You wouldn't get that. There are a lot of other oddities with the situation, which got me thinking that you had to have some sort of energy source that could travel, like to reflect down and hit the cars. It couldn't be, like, if it was a nuke, you would expect it to have a center focus where it's hottest, then you have someplace else that's colder, and then you have all shades of gray in between. We do not have that. Nor do we have the impact of that much material hitting the ground. There's a lot of details that I've put together as to what happened. Now, for how it happened, I think John has some pretty good ideas about that, and I'd love for him to tell us about them.
John, go ahead.
Yes, what I would say here is that it's possible to have a beam operating from orbit which is a laser beam, which is driven by free electron lasers, for example, and which is driven by solar energy. I've been publishing on this subject for 40 years, well, most of 40 years, and in technical journals, mainly on account of the fact that such a system could produce all the energy that Earth would ever want to use. We currently use about 40 terawatts, and I could give you four times that much with a system that's 344 miles in diameter for the collector, the solar collector, 364 miles. Anyway, such a system could have been used to produce those holes that Judy is talking about.
You may be familiar with a lot of the criticism my data gets. It's no big conclusion. I'm just presenting the data, and we have to figure out how it was done. And I suggested it came from above, whether it was reflected up and then back down, or if it was initiated from above and went directly down. And the biggest criticism is, well, we don't see a big extension cord reaching up there to a satellite. So how could it possibly have that much energy up there?
Right. Well, we're talking about if we want to fuse steel, we're talking about how much energy does it take to fuse all of the steel in the supports of the floors of the World Trade Center. A World Trade Center tower would take about 81.2, according to my calculations, million kilowatts. And of course, the sun produces all the kilowatts you want, you could ever want. And the question is, how efficiently can you send it down by laser? Well, the free electron laser is about 35%. That's average efficiency. So it's very efficient and also very powerful. But it operates at a most efficiently at a frequency of about, well, of a microwave frequency. Well, it's halfway between microwave and infrared. It operates most efficiently there, and I presume that's where it would be used for this kind of a thing. That's what I would use it for peaceful purposes. So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a potential of a system that could operate from orbit. That would be a synchronous orbit, 22,240 miles high. A synchronous orbit satellite is almost, well, it's not directly overhead, but it's overhead constantly, and this would make it possible to direct a beam like this and control it and turn it on and off and so forth.
Could there be more than one and have them coordinated?
More than one satellite?
Yes.
Oh, sure. Of course. But that would be entirely possible, sure. You could have them spaced out in orbit, or you could have them operating from a single less approximate site, you know, above. So this could explain how the holes were created. I personally think that there was, in addition to, I think this was the system was tested. I'm not sure that it brought down the towers all by itself. I think there was a demolition, a conventional demolition. About 11 points of the collapse of the World Trade Center were identical to conventional demolition of high-rise buildings, and there were hundreds of pieces of bone found on adjacent buildings' roofs, which would have been caused by explosions, only by explosions. It couldn't have been caused by my system. But I think my system would account for example, for the molten iron in the basement, because if you're melting all of that steel in the structure, or much of it, then a lot of it's going to drip through to the basement. And so I think it could be this rather than the thermite that caused the collection of steel in the basement.
Well, good. What possible other devices might also explain this?
Well, there are a couple of others, secret weapon type things. One that Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Bearden has talked about are scalar wave electromagnetics. These things operate by crossing a couple of beams from different points And at the point that they intersect, you have an, you can have an explosion that's only short of nuclear. This can be controlled, he claims, by a person sitting in a control booth far distant from the site. This is all I know about this. I don't know a lot about it, but this is... And then there's also a question of the HAARP. I don't know a lot about that either, but it is claimed that it could produce explosions at a given site. So we could be dealing with secret weapons of either any one of these three.
Is there, you know, my background is in optics and more in interferometry, to be specific.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of two-beam interference, how you have constructive and destructive interference. Is there something analogous to that that might have caused it, where you have two different beams that intersect and cause some other result?
Well, that's exactly what the scalar wave system that Bearden talks about would be, although, of course, it was originally based on a technology that was developed by Nikola Tesla back in the late 1800s and early 1900s. Yes, that's exactly what that kind of a system is. It is an interference of two beams. And, again, this would... Be a very, very dangerous sort of a system. And Bearden talks about it in those terms, and evidently we've come to the point that we have such deadly weapons that weapons are no longer of any significance in human affairs.
The big concern I have is if something like this really exists, and it only takes one person to push the button, you could have 99.99% of the planet knowing the ramifications of it, but then you could have one insane person who, if I can't have the world, nobody else can, and pushes the button.
Oh, of course, all kinds of things like that can happen. We need to have controls, as Dr. Greer says. You have dangerous people out there, and you need to put controls on them. Of course.
That's a pretty good solution.
Mm-hmm.
What you mentioned about peaceful and good uses of these things, what such uses might you see as to why this type of weapon would be developed? I would think the people developing the weapon would feel very unhappy about themselves and not be able to deal with developing such a weapon that was capable of such destruction. So I'm thinking that there might have been an easy way to sell it as a peaceful kind use. What might that be?
Well, yes, definitely. A lot of my research was trying to devise how such an energy-producing system could send probes to the nearest stars. It was believed that you couldn't do this. You can't send a probe to a different star by any kind of a manned system. Well, I proved that we can generate sufficient energy in a laser beam to do it. Then it occurred to me that kind of energy, of course, could survive, could be supplied to the planet to take the place of all the hydropower, the coal and oil burning, and the nuclear and so forth. In other words, all of the energy on planet Earth could be supplied from orbit by this kind of a system. The way that you would collect it would be what I call a beanstalk, which is a balloon at 80,000 feet, which is covered with solar cells, for example. There are other ways to do it, which is supply energy to the planet. And the planet only uses a total today all about 15 terawatts. That's 15 trillion watts of energy. And that's everything everywhere. And we could quadruple that or multiply it by four and have 60 terawatts with a system of the kind I'm talking about that would be 364 miles in diameter for the collector. In orbit. Consequently, with energy is money, and with this kind of a system to supply energy to the planet, we could have global prosperity. We could have vast desalinization of salt water. We could turn the Sahara Desert into a garden. We could restore the Amazon jungle. We could repair the ozone if necessary. For example, we could also control the CO2, we could get rid of it, and we could cool the planet and keep it at whatever temperature you want.
Well, so why hasn't this been done yet?
Well, I don't
Is this what everybody
know.
Wants?
but I suspect that that we currently that people are still thinking in terms of zero sum competitions on Earth, because the people are assuming that we have only a limited number of resources, and therefore everybody is struggling over those resources. But the world actually, with science, in other words, the number resources defined by the scientific principles of the time, what is trash or garbage today with scientific principles can be turned into valuable resources tomorrow. For example, well, this system of free energy, orbital energy, means that we could have so many and so much resources that we don't need to consider that we have a zero-sum game. We have a non-zero-sum game, meaning that there is an effectively infinite supply of resources, so we don't have to struggle and fight and quarrel and contend over resources any longer.
Well, those who are in charge of the resources now, or the energy supplies now, would no longer have that corner on the market.
Well, that's true, and I feel that it's just that they don't understand that the world has moved on and on and on, and they're still sort of stuck back in the 19th century of zero-sum gamesmanship, whereas today we have a non-zero-sum gamesmanship situation, and I think that they're just a little behind the times, and I think they're catching up.
I think of the water rights situation in the desert Southwest, and mm-hmm. how Native Americans were just so tuned into nature and how to distribute that water that there became a problem when somebody else wanted to control the water, because water was life. Water was agriculture. Water was gold.
Mm-hmm.
And controlling water then is probably like controlling energy now. And if you had this other supply of infinite energy, free energy, would it still be free?
Oh, well, it should be kept free, and it would be kept free. My system is only an introductory, sort of a crude system, because it's based on conventional science, conventional physics and chemistry and physical chemistry and mathematics. But there are other things coming along which are much considerably better than mine. Mine may have some special purposes, use, but there are other things that which are coming along, which are for the general purpose energy, or even better, something you can put on your table and drive your house, for example, and for indefinitely. I think that the systems that are coming along are actually better than mine for a lot of purposes, and they're easier to distribute. But mine is taking a central source, of course. Therefore, I think those systems will eventually overtake us. But they're based on scientific principles which are beyond what we have in the textbooks today, so it's kind of hard to get going. So it's going to take a while, but I think my system could provide an interim solution to the energy problem.
So is there an example of how this actually works? One of the criticisms, of course, to my work is saying, well, that couldn't have existed because it's like the knowing of slingshots, you know, and BB guns. Those are the only things that are acceptable. And these 24-foot diameter holes must have been made out of something we already know about, because we need to have it provable. Is there any example you can give for how this thing does work, that it's not just in a future idea?
Well, just the laser principle, we understand, and we have a lot of experience with lasers today. They can punch holes in things, and the more power you have, the bigger the laser, the bigger, the deeper the hole. For example, it's just a matter of noting that here is how a laser works. If you have a very, very large laser pointed down, for example, with a lot of power, we're talking about 64 million kilowatts here, for example, as a minimum, then you can punch holes like this through everything. Everything gets vaporized with that kind of power. As we know, a laser beam at the focus can vaporize just about anything.
And before I knew what was available out there, I just had put together what had happened, what I saw at the World Trade Center, through all the various images. And from that is why how I concluded that it had to be some sort of energy beam. And with my background in optics, interference seemed likely because of the what happened with the cars over in FDR Drive, the toasted cars. And then, okay, if I'm going to start to explain it, I think of the microwave oven being invented in 1945 and lasers in the mid-50s. And I would think they've advanced a lot more since then. We have laser pointers as keychain ornaments, and you can get, you know, various colors. They come in red, blue, you know, green. Pick your flavor. So there's a big wide spectrum of wavelengths of energy, and we know that they've been advanced significantly since 1945 or 1955.
Mm-hmm.
And just extrapolating from there, I can only imagine, but I haven't seen it. Mm-hmm. For the World Trade Center, if such a weapon was used, what would we see? What would we expect to see?
Well, pretty much what you've described. I presume that if it's operating from synchronous orbit 22,240 miles,
What does it mean, synchronous orbit?
They're probably hunting and pecking around a bit, and I presume that the purpose here was not so much to destroy the World Trade Centers as it was to test the weapon. In other words, I think the destruction was pretty much handled by the controlled demolition, but I think they wanted to test this out at the same time, because it was an opportunity to really test this system. And it would definitely punch that kind of holes and cause that kind of damage. We're talking about, say, 64 million of kilowatts, 64 million kilowatts in the actual focus, and the focus would be only 24, 25 feet in diameter. Therefore, you would cause some tremendous damage in a hurry, a real hurry, and the very deep. It's going to go very deep. About the concrete, there was 425 million tons of concrete or something like that in the World Trade Centers, and all of it was turned to dust, which is entirely microscopic dust, which is entirely, I think, although I haven't really done much research on this, it does sound as if this could have been caused by that kind of heat in a laser beam focus, you know.
I know that if you get concrete hot and if it has any moisture in it, the thermal expansion happening very quickly at all, the concrete will explode.
For example, yes, and this kind—I don't think anyone, in my experience or knowledge, has ever applied this kind of heat to a piece of concrete. But if it were done, I would expect some pretty drastic
explosions.
Products, yeah. The fine dust sounds entirely reasonable.
I mean, how about the steel? If you apply this to steel, what would happen?
The steel is going to be, of course, first of all, fused, and then if it's heated sufficiently, it's going to vaporize. The iron latent heat of vaporization, well, this is physics 101, but the melting point of iron is 2,795 degrees Fahrenheit. The specific heat is, in other words, how much heat does it take to raise a pound of iron one, and we're talking about steel, but steel is mostly iron,
mm-hmm.
Raised at 1 degree Fahrenheit. Anyway, the latent heat of fusion is only 116.97 BTUs per pound, a British thermal unit, BTU, which means the amount of heat that takes to raise 1 pound of water, 1 degree Fahrenheit. The iron boiling point is kind of unusual to think of iron as boiling, but think of it as a boiling point. It has a boiling point of 5,428.4 degrees Fahrenheit. And if you start your whole heating process at 72 degrees Fahrenheit, then the fact is that to heat a pound of iron to fusing temperature takes 202.7 BTUs per pound. And then to fuse it, of course, you have to supply the latent heat of fusion, so the total to fuse it per pound is 409.67 BTUs. And then if you want to vaporize it, you have to add enough heat to raise it to the boiling temperature, which, but then if you want to vaporize it, you have to add another 1,997.6 BTUs per pound. Well, this sounds like a lot of big numbers, but what it means is that you can actually conceive of, with a laser beam of this kind, fusing iron and then, or liquefying and then boiling it. And if it's boiled, of course, it's going to vaporize. That's perhaps what happened to a lot of iron in the World Trade Center. It was along with other things, which were either vaporized or turned to dust.
As I was looking at all of the various images of the site, and, you know, I'm sure we've all heard those stories about the fires that burned for 99 days. I began to conclude that, and I didn't see any evidence of fires. For example, by the end of the first week, there are pictures of rescue workers rappelling down into a hole in the middle of Building 2, where Building 2 had stood, looking for survivors. And then it looks like they're standing in a wet, damp basement. So what was the story about all of the fires that burned forever? And I got to thinking that if you vaporize material, you have this outgassing of the material, or whatever it is, let's call it nano dust, coming off of the pile. And that's going to be coming off for quite a while, and they're going to need a cover story for that. They were hosing down the pile. I have pictures of it in March. They're still hosing it down. But there's a picture that was taken maybe within a few weeks, and you have this looming kind of bluish fog over the piles that there's no specific point source. If it was a fire, you have the smokestack of where the fire, underground fire, would be, you know, venting. But this is just a haze over the pile.
Well, it could be formed by such things as the fused iron in the basement. I don't know how long it takes iron to cool down. That quantity of iron would be a tremendous quantity. There was 400 million, the total amount of steel in the World Trade Centers was, I've written down here, some 400 million tons, something like that. Along those lines, surprised me in reading about people who had gone into the trade centers during that time was that they all noticed a tremendous amount of heat. Well, the heat would have had to come from the combustion of the jet fuel plus the combustion of the office equipment, the head desks and so forth in the offices, but the desks and the jet fuel could not possibly have caused that much heat. So the heat, I presume, came from the beam, from the laser beam. I don't know where else it could have come from. They all talk about a tremendous amount of heat inside the building
or the collapse. What I found interesting is there are a lot of stories of, for example, rivers of molten steel and molten metal. But all of the photographs I've seen, you know, thousands. I have not seen any evidence of it. And you have rescue dogs running around in there looking for survivors, and they don't have any gloves on their hands, you know, their paws, and they don't appear to be burnt in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder how these stories can exist with the rescue dogs not getting their feet burned.
I don't know, but of course the rescue dogs, if they're down at a lower level and the heat is being applied from the top, then they're going to be insulated until the heat actually reaches down, you know, until the beam focus actually reaches down to them. Fact that they talked about molten, I read about molten aluminum, but I haven't read about molten steel, but it's possible, of course. In fact, it does appear that if this kind of a system was what happened when to cause the molten iron in the basement, then of course there would have been rivulets of molten iron coming down off of the building into the basement. This would be localized. In other words, it would be a rivulet here, a rivulet there. The dogs wouldn't have to have been treading on anything that hot.
True, and in various places.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't see any pictures. I would think there would be something somewhere that would indicate a hot spot. You have, you know, puddles of water in the basement that don't have steam rising off of them, mm-hmm. which is interesting. Is it possible that from the top down the building could be vaporized?
Oh, it seems to me very possible, because if you're supplying that kind of heat from a laser beam, 25 feet in diameter at the focus, then it's going to pretty much vaporize everything that it hits.
So if it's vaporized, then
I think
you don't have it molten dripping down.
Excuse me?
So if it's been vaporized, it's gone.
Well,
it's gone
the very top surface would be vaporized, of course, of anything that hits, but below that, it's going to be simply fused. And in other words, if you're hitting a puddle of anything with a beam like this, it's going to vaporize from the top, but the volume below is going to be merely fused, and, you know. So you'd have both things happening at the same time.
Okay.
So anyway, it does appear that your supposition is correct, that these holes would have been formed by in this manner. I don't know how else they could have been formed. Then they were there. You have photographic evidence.
Yeah, one of my favorite ones is the hole in the street, in the middle of Liberty Street. Nice round hole.
Seriously, I didn't know about that.
And it's judging by some of the beams you see in the picture, knowing that the beams that go into the ground of the outer wall of WTC-2 are 10 foot center to center. And you can see that there's, you know, this hole is like 2.5 of those across. If you had a big pickup truck, you could just drop it down that hole. But from the satellite image, it's a very round hole. And you notice other round holes in the ground around Building 2 next to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I've been presuming that the laser was continuous wave. Of course, it could have been a pulse laser, and if that were the case, then when you turn it on, you don't necessarily know exactly where it's pointed, and therefore you're going to have a succession of holes which are more or less random while you're trying to aim it, if you are trying to aim it, whatever you're trying to do with it.
And that hole in the street is right between the Bankers Trust building and where Building 2 was. And if you notice the front of the Bankers Trust building, it has this big arc cutout going down the front of it that looks like it's the edge of a cylindrical beam.
Hmm.
It's very interesting. And then there's a picture that was in the NIST report of a structural beam from the building hanging out in the middle of that cutout that looks like kind of shriveled up on one end. For example, if you pull a hair out of your head and then scrape your fingernail along it, it'll coil up. It looks like that on the end, or ribbon that you wrap packages with. It looks kind of shriveled up on the end. Very odd effect. It is not mechanical damage that caused that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it doesn't sound like mechanical. It sounds more like heat. So I think you're entirely correct.
But it's very short acting. Because the rest of the beam is just fine. It didn't conduct very far up past, you know, just the tip of that beam.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this would be my personal theory on how those holes could have been formed. And the free electron laser is one of the latest and most powerful and the most advanced laser of all, and the most efficient, and the most, well, I say most powerful. The information I have on it is dating back to the early 90s, and I haven't been easily able to obtain much more information. I presume it's pretty much gone deeply underground, because it was a very promising system. Of course, it's being used for things, you know, for medical purposes and things like that, but if you're talking about massive macro lasers, then it's probably the most promising of all, and also it's the most promising for my purposes, the peaceful purposes of supplying energy, because of its very high efficiency and its very powerful output. Also, I'm reading that it's compact. It can be quite compact. The free electron laser, it draws on American science's vast information, vast knowledge and experience in particle accelerators. It's a somewhat different kind of laser from any of the others. It's based on accelerating electrons.
One of the items of criticism I hear is that those with a telescope or binoculars might see it up there in space, something that was, it would have to be so massive to make these holes that, you know, novices would be able to easily see it up there orbiting the Earth.
I think that's kind of doubtful. The sun, for example, subtends about 30 minutes of arc, or half a degree, and this would take a, well, for example, to at 18% efficiency to deliver a 25-foot diameter spot.
How long would it take?
It would take a collector, solar collector, only 15.8 miles in diameter, according to my calculations, and if it's at 22,240 miles above Earth, then the angle subtended by this collector would be only 2.44 minutes, and that's about 8% of the size of the sun. So unless you're looking for it, you're probably not going to see it, I think. Also, it could be turned sideways when not in use, and it wouldn't be in use most of the time. If it's turned sideways, you're not going to see it. And another possibility, we're only talking about a solar collector, which is low efficiency, which I mean has a low surface tolerance necessary. You could also use a Venetian blind approach, as Frank Ferguson has mentioned.
I know I've tried to find the International Space Station overhead with binoculars when I've known it was supposed to be passing overhead. And the only way I found that you can really see it is right at sunrise or right at sunset, where you're still in the dark, but you see sunlight reflecting off of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And without that sun reflecting off of it, you don't see it.
Yeah, well, you can imagine that at 22,240 miles altitude, a 15.8-mile diameter mirror
is nothing.
It's going to subtend 2.44 minutes. That's what I calculate arc minutes here, which is pretty hard to see. Very hard to see.
One thing that I found very fascinating is that I had posted that the holes were approximately 24 feet in diameter. Mm-hmm. And that was before I knew about you, before I had met you.
Mm-hmm.
And you had come up with 25 feet diameter affected zones on the Earth from this item.
Well, that was only by having looked at your photographs,
okay,
and guessing at the diameter size of them. But using that figure, I did my calculation.
Oh, okay.
And I used your figure to count my mirror size.
How long have you known about this type of energy source being available?
Well, I originally invented this kind of an orbital optical system back in 1963, and I applied for patent in 65, and I only as a telescope mirror, as a mirror. In other words, a telescope receives light, but a laser beam former sends out light, but it takes the same kind of a system. Essentially, a light is reversible. So I applied for patent, and I was served a military secrecy order that said, keep your mouth shut about this, or you go to prison for 2 years and pay $10,000 fine. And I protested loudly, and Senator Murphy of California got it rescinded, and also the Small Business Administration got it rescinded. And then I was originally thinking of it as a telescope, and then I got to thinking of it as a method of sending propulsion for propulsion for spaceships. To send a spaceship to the nearest star was considered to be impossible by almost everybody, and I calculated that by this system of constructing solar energy and sending out a laser beam, we could overcome that obstacle, and we could actually send ships to the nearest stars. I published a paper which I called the Alpha Centauri probe, and I showed therein that we could send a probe past Alpha Centauri, which is the nearest star, 4.3 light years away. We could send it by there at 25% of the speed of light. And subsequently, I published other papers in which I showed that we could actually send out manned expeditions and get them back alive by using this kind of a system. It's a very big, very big, a lot of business is required there. There are better ways to do it, I think, today in the free energy circles of people that are studying this. How do the UFOs operate? For example, they if you operate like a UFO, then you don't have to mess with a laser beam. But I got to thinking about also then the application of my orbital optical apparatus, which would send down very tightly limited expanding beams. In other words, very, very tight beams. I got to thinking of that for the purpose of supplying energy to the planet to overcome the problems of having to rely on oil and hydropower and all the limitations we have on energy supplies. With energy, of course, is like money. It's the thing that that you have to have in order to have an advanced civilization. And so the planet, the people on Earth desperately need much, much more energy, and my system could supply it. As I say, with today's being the total energy supply on the planet today is only about 15 terawatts, and I could supply with my system. I'm grateful to this interview with you here and this whole question that you raised, because it stimulated me to do a lot more research on my orbital optical apparatus for supplying utility energy to the planet. So it does appear that with a 344-mile diameter collector, which is not that considerable, this would be a mirror made out of aluminized mylar, for example. That's what we used back in the 60s, and probably still good enough. We could supply four times the energy to the planet that it's currently using. Everything for everybody. Mm. The global supply of energy. So with a system like this, we could raise the standard of living of everyone everywhere to whatever height you want to raise it.
That's amazing.
In other words, it's a method of creating a kind of millennium, you might say.
Mm-hmm. That was the voice of John Bloomer, and we've had this very detailed discussion between him and Judy Wood, and we're going to open the phones now so you can ask them questions. The number to call is 588-0893. And caller, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, hi.
You're on. Hello?
Hello?
Good morning, Ambrose.
Yes.
Okay, I'm glad I got through. Listen, I need to know the names of the two people you have speaking. I need to know the website. And if I can get a copy of today's show, I communicate with a person who has their own radio show. It's called Blog Radio. This would be wonderful for one of her topics.
Very good. The website is Jane Doe.
Jane, D-O-E.
0911. 0911. Dot.
Mm-hmm. Tripod. Spell that for me.
T-R-I-P-O-D.
Uh-huh.
Dot com.
And you said, she said there's no W.
That's right.
Okay. All right. And their names?
And that's the Professor Judy Wood, W-O-O-D, and John Bloomer, B-L-O-O-M-E-R.
M-E-R.
Yeah, and you can listen to this again on weourselves.org.
Weourselves.org.
Mm-hmm.
And what would I click on to listen to that?
You just go to the site and you'll find out. It's very simple. Oh, WeAreSales.org.
Okay. Thank you so very much. This is so wonderfully interesting.
Isn't it?
Yes. I always had an idea that Bush had something to do with it. I knew it wasn't no Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden. It was Bush.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Good morning, Carly. You're on.
Good morning, Ambrose. How you doing?
Good.
I want to say you are a gift from above.
No, my guests are.
Thank you for the true treats.
You got it.
The doctors, your special guests, it's always an enlightenment. I wanted to ask a question. Do you think the Hubble telescope could be put into the equation?
If you're asking me, I'd like to
go right
talk
here.
About that.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Hubble telescope is of course the most advanced optical system that we've ever had in orbit, and at 94 inches in the diameter of the primary mirror, it's also the most expensive at $3 billion. And the cost of optics is very much a question here. We're talking about the cost of optics, of major optics, of telescope, major telescopes. On the ground goes up by the fourth power of the diameter, normally, and of course the Hubble was in orbit, and at $3 billion, if we're talking about expanding this to a mirror, for my application, which would be 3,080 feet in diameter, liquid surfaced. That's the principle I've evolved here, is liquid surface, because I've shown that liquid surface can do everything that solid can do, and do it better and far, far cheaper. In orbit, liquid surface it behaves differently, far differently than it does on the ground. Anyway, it does appear that if we use the conventional system, a rule of fourth power of the diameter, that a 3,080-foot diameter telescope in orbit or anywhere else would cost, by that rule, 24 million trillion, which is, of course, it wouldn't be as expensive as normal for a telescope to operate in the visible, because we're not operating in the visible, we're operating only in the infrared and microwave, which is 200 microns, or 200 millionths of is the wavelength. So anyway, it's going to be cheaper than that. But we're talking about a tremendous amount of money to build a system in orbit that operates as I've been describing, which would do what you're talking about doing. But unless you do it my way, in other words, unless you do it the way I've proposed to do it and invented and applied for patent, it wouldn't be conceivable or feasible, I think, for the money that the Defense Department has, anybody else has.
Before I met John, I had been looking around the Internet to see what was available in the public domain, and I found this document. It's the third appendix in this Star Wars beam weapon document. Mm-hmm. There's also some other ones in the second appendix page, but they have in the public domain this summary of what's available and how much each program costs, and they're weighing out the difference between space-based lasers and ground-based lasers, and how the space-based lasers were a whole lot cheaper. It could exact price, but the highest end was around $81 billion. And the lower end was around $17 billion, but it was in the triple digits for the ground-based laser.
Oh, that's very interesting.
And when I saw that, I got the creeps. That's the first time through this whole thing I've gotten the creeps, because that made it kind of real that they'd even summarized the price list. But in there, they said that they're looking at what technology needed to be developed to put this in action. And as for the optics, no breakthroughs needed, was the statement.
All right. Good morning, Carl. You're on.
Yes, good morning. Good morning to your panel, and good morning to you, Mr. Lane.
Yes.
This is for your panel. your two guests. Mm-hmm. Please bear with my scientific illiteracy, but from what I'm hearing, I'm astounded. And what I'm trying to ask is, the gentleman's scientific applications and theories for energy alternatives, which are very interesting, how then will you forward these findings and applications to someone or some body of persons or individuals who can implement this in the future? Because you're manifesting a scientific application that will perhaps save this humanity on this planet, mm-hmm. and we can get off our dependency of fossil fuels. I believe in what you're saying. I think it's possible. It may not be in my lifetime, but it's something that's very astounding to me. And the lady who specializes in optics, some of her her theories and applications are quite mind-boggling as well, and they're not far-fetched. So I think that your sources of information as far as energy alternatives, as well as the lady's theories on some of the serious problems with the Ground Zero the towers being destroyed, makes a lot of sense. And also, do you think any of your scientific theories can help us to alleviate or eradicate some of the dangerous scientific satellites and spy satellites in outer space? Used to call them killer satellites back in the 80s that were out there destroying very vital satellite systems in orbit. And what do you think your systems will do to perhaps prevent that from getting even serious? And also, can you say anything about the Windhoe Lee case? I'll hang up and listen to you on the rare. Thank you very much.
I didn't know about the case. But essentially, what we're talking about here is a non-zero game kind, a non-zero sum kind of a game permitted by unlimited energy. In other words, instead of struggling over things on the planet and having killer satellites and things like that, we don't need them. We have peace, we have prosperity, and we have relegated all this stuff, all this zero-sum game stuff to the past. In other words, in zero some game, you're all struggling for the same pile of goodies. But if the goodies pile is infinitely high, you don't need to struggle anymore. And consequently, yes, we can zap killer satellites and things like that, but we don't need to. We can enjoy all the benefits of prosperity, and energy is money, is prosperity, and we're talking about a way of supplying energy.
There's something else I'd like to answer about what the caller said that struck me. He said not in his lifetime. Well, that even meant in his children's lifetime, in his grandchildren's lifetime. And if we can reverse global warming and take care of our environment, there will be a lifetime for his grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
Beyond.
And you think that these can reverse global warming?
Oh, yes, easily. If we're talking about, number one, cutting off the source of global warming, which evidently is CO2 production, which have similar kind of things in different periods, of course, but this explosion at the center of the galaxy sends off cosmic rays, which in a secondary way do a lot of damage to us and have wiped out most of the surface life on planet Earth. He's expecting a new one to come any time. And, of course, a system like what I'm proposing would be a way of deflecting that kind of threat, too.
That was the voice of John Bloomer, and we have been fortunate to have him and Judy Wood in the studio. And you can get all of these shows on my website, which is weourselves.org, and We Ourselves Yahoo Group. So you can hear it again, and I want to thank them once more for being here to share this information, this vital information, with our listeners. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, everybody, I guess we're signing off then, huh?
That's right. Thanks so much, John.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. And that's going to do it for today. We'll have a great weekend, and we'll see you at the top of the week. Take care.